Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Today's program is the eighth in the Commonwealth Club series on social entrepreneurship. I'm Dr. Ruth Shapiro, social entrepreneur in residence at the Commonwealth Club, and I'll be moderating the program tonight. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Premal Shah. As one of the co-founders of Kiva, Premal has been at the forefront of bringing capital to grassroots businesses in rural areas of developing countries for several years now. In late 2004, Premal was working at PayPal. He took a three-month sabbatical in order to explore the viability of internet-based microfinance in India. When he returned to Silicon Valley, he quit his job at PayPal, teamed up with Matt Flannery, and created Kiva. Today, Kiva raises over $1 million a week for working people and businessmen and women in 50 countries, including the United States. In fact, Kiva partners with the Opportunity Fund to make loans available in the Bay Area. It is clear that Kiva has become extremely successful, as it is now listed on Oprah's Ultimate Favorite Things for 2010 between Judith Ripka Jewelry and Kisora Ceramic Knives. For his work as a social entrepreneur, Premal was named a Young Global Leader by the World Economic Forum and selected by Fortune Magazine Top 40 Under 40 list in 2009. Premal also graduated from a university we may have heard of, Stanford, a few years before. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Premal Shah.
Hey, everyone. Thanks, Ruth, for that kind introduction, and thanks for everyone braving the rain to come to this series in social entrepreneurship. I'm really glad that the movement in social entrepreneurship is spreading as fast as it is. I'd like to start with talking a little bit about my story and why I'm here before I get into some of the details about Kiva. So when I was 5 years old, I was taken to India by my parents. I lived in Minnesota, in the suburbs of Minnesota, and I had, right when you step off the flight in Mumbai, India, you know, you realize you're in a very different place. And at that age, I remember being really overwhelmed with what I was seeing because it was nothing like Minnesota. This is a common scene in the place that we went, which is in Ahmedabad, and which is in the state of Gujarat. And I remember when I was walking around with my mom one day, I was holding onto a 1 rupee coin, and I had this fascination with just holding onto this coin, as kids do. And I must have held it for hours. And while we're walking through a market area, there was an open sewage stream in that market, and I dropped that coin accidentally in that sewage. And my mom kind of yanked my hand and said, "Don't pick up that coin." And the coin, by the way, it's a 1 rupee coin, so it's less than a penny in value. It's dirty. And I remember then watching within seconds a woman who was older than my mother, in a very ragged sari, coming over, putting her hand into the sewage, and finding the coin, and then looking up at the sky and thanking God for having found that 1 rupee coin. And that was a really poignant, that event, as well as that whole trip to India, probably changed the trajectory of my life because, you know, I just saw firsthand the indignity and the injustice that's happening every day on this planet, very firsthand. And I know from that point, I always wanted to do something for the world or to address it, but I didn't actually know how. And I think a lot of us are in this situation right now where we see an issue that we really care about: global warming, poverty, education reform, and it's often difficult to actually figure out a simple way to actually do something about it. And for me, it was on my mind for quite some time until I got to college, and I remember that's when I first discovered microfinance. And microfinance, which is, think of it as the provision of financial services for typically the people who are underbanked or underserved, it seemed like such an amazing idea to me because it was this business approach to poverty alleviation, the idea that microcredit, which is one aspect of microfinance, the idea that a small loan could help, say, a woman in Uganda buy a cow, and with that small loan, she could then start a dairy business, and not only kind of repay that loan one day, but that could have this multiplier effect of being able to provide for her family. It just sounded like this incredible business approach to poverty alleviation that was very sustainable to me. But the other thing I really liked about it is that, unlike a lot of top-down, large aid projects, I really like the bottoms-up nature of it. It's this idea that all of us here in the North could support leadership in the South, and that's something that I thought was really, really powerful about the idea as well. So I fell in love with microcredit in college, and then went on to the corporate world, and in the back of my mind, wanted to one day return back. And I was lucky enough to land at PayPal, and while I was at PayPal, one of the cool things about that was not only the fact that, I was learning how I could build a product that would allow people to send money, from one point on the planet to another place on the planet, but PayPal was really popular on eBay. And on eBay, this is, if you think about it, it's kind of a miracle because, 25 years ago, the idea that you could actually buy a television or a radio from a complete stranger that you'll never meet, and that they'll actually ship it to you, and that these transactions happen on eBay every single day. People are buying cars on eBay. The idea that people are trusting complete strangers and able to trade directly with them online, I always marveled at that. So PayPal was interesting because it allowed for payment facilitation, but it's what we were doing on eBay and the connections between people over commerce that was inspired by trust. That was something that was pretty revolutionary. And so I was wondering, could we actually set up a site, or maybe on eBay, if people are willing to buy a Beanie Baby or a television or an automobile, would they be willing to make a loan on eBay? And so in 2005, I went to India in early 2005 on a sabbatical from PayPal, and I worked at a non-governmental organization, an NGO in Gujarat, India. And there, I basically tried to test the idea of taking a photo of an entrepreneur and, in the test category of eBay, just listing up a microcredit loan request and seeing if anyone would actually hit buy it now. And so instead of bidding, it would be a buy it now. It's $100. If anyone actually did it, then I would get the money out using my PayPal ATM card in local rupees, give it to that person, and then maybe one of my friends would collect that money over time. That's what I was thinking. It would just be a small pilot. And what was really exciting is, I did that at the end of the day from an internet cafe after volunteering, and I went to sleep that night. And obviously while you're sleeping in India, it's daytime over here. So I rushed back, the next morning to see if anyone had hit the buy it now button and wanted to make a loan to this first, microloan recipient on eBay. And no one had actually done it yet, but there's a counter on the bottom of every eBay page that shows you how many people have hit the page. And something like 45 people had actually hit the page. So I was like, wow, at least people are looking at it. That's kind of exciting. And so then I go, I was volunteering at a women's economic empowerment cooperative. I go do that, come back later that evening to the internet cafe to see if anyone hit buy it now yet on the eBay listing. And it was missing. And I was like, what happened to it? And I checked my email, and I had gotten an automated email from eBay's legal department saying that requesting loans on eBay is illegal. It's against the SEC. It's a violation of its terms of service. Now, they had no idea that PayPal, which I was employee of still, which was owned by eBay, that I was actually an employee of the company and that I was violating their terms of use because I had an anonymous handle like SalsaBoy20 or something. So, you know, they had no way of tracking me down. But, you know, I essentially came back from India and I was really excited about this idea. Is there a way to actually post up microloan requests of people who just need a little bit of money and connect them with people who have just a little bit money, who wouldn't mind making a loan online? And in that time, I came back to Palo Alto, California, and I ran into two amazing social entrepreneurs, Matt and Jessica Flannery, who had started a small website but is still in pilot form called Kiva. And it was exactly what I wanted to do. And so instead of trying to compete with them, I said, hey, can we all work together? And we said, sure. But when we first started it, there was a lot of things that we weren't sure about, and there's a lot of naysayers to the idea. And I'll get into some of the challenges that we had early on. But for those of you who have never visited the site, let me just explain what Kiva is. Kiva is a website, and it's run by a 501c3 nonprofit based in San Francisco. And on this website, similar to eBay, where you can sift through profiles of things that you may want to buy, in this case, you will sift through profiles of entrepreneurs in over 50 countries. And these entrepreneurs are looking for a microloan ranging from as little as $25 to as large as $10,000, for example, here in the U.S. And then if you find an entrepreneur that resonates with you, for example, Anne Marie in Benin, you can read her story. Maybe she, in this case, she wants to purchase condiments and fish for her retail outlet, and she's looking for $325 from the internet community. You have the opportunity to basically lend $25 or more towards this profile. Now, the way that this profile gets posted up on Kiva is that we work with local microfinance institutions. These are banks for the poor. The most famous one is like the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh, the founder of which won the Nobel Peace Prize back in 2006. And what's really exciting about these organizations is that oftentimes the ones that Kiva works with, they're not very large. They're small community-based organizations. They're kind of barely self-sustainable themselves. And what they're really looking for is capital. If they can actually access more capital, they could actually reach more of the entrepreneurs in their community and help more people. And the issue that they find is because they're so small and so unproven, it's very hard to actually attract capital as one of these community-based microfinance organizations. So now the internet community, all of us, has the opportunity to support these organizations and the entrepreneurs that they serve. Now, once you hit lend now for $25 or something more, what will happen then is essentially over the course of a year, the loan will be repaid. Usually the average loan term on Kiva is about 10 months. So if it's $25 that you lend, you'll get every month in your email $2.50 back. And then when you get kind of all $25 paid back to you, you can turn around and either re-lend it to another entrepreneur, maybe someone in Cambodia, or you can withdraw that money back to your PayPal account if you need the money. And so that's essentially how Kiva works. And one of the cool things is not only do you get kind of your money back, but you also get updates on how that business is doing and the progress or the lack of progress that it's made. So that's how the Kiva website works. And since launching it 5 years ago, it's really taken off, although in the beginning it was pretty slow going. We've now hit $177 million in loans in these $25 chunks, and that's come from over 760,000 individuals on the internet in over 100 countries, not just the U.S., but we're seeing people from all over the world making loans. And that goes via a network of 135 field partners in 54 countries around the planet, and that's touched the lives of 420,000 entrepreneurs. And what's a real testament to the working poor and the entrepreneurs on Kiva is that today there's a 98.9% repayment rate on the Kiva marketplace. So it's incredible that if the working poor gets an opportunity at credit, gets an opportunity that they can't get elsewhere, they take it very seriously, and the repayment rates can be quite high. Now, I want to talk about some of the challenges that we've had in getting Kiva started. The big three were, in the beginning, keeping the lights on. The second one was keeping loans on the website. And then the third were keeping Kiva lenders engaged. So let me talk about the first. When we when, you know, after I quit my job and Matt quit his job at TiVo, he was a computer programmer. It was a bunch of volunteers, about six of us sitting in the office. We were on the kitchen table in Palo Alto, California, and then we eventually moved up to San Francisco. And literally, it was seven volunteers. No one was getting paid, and we needed to put people on healthcare. And if you typed in Kiva into Google, the top search result was a spa. And like, I even looked in the database, and my mom and dad had not even used the website. So, like, I couldn't get, like, my closest friends and family to use the website. It was like crickets and tumbleweed. People were being posted up on the website, but the funding wasn't really coming. And we went like that for about a year, and we finally started putting people about 8 or 9 months in onto healthcare and some basic wages. And we had about 1 month of payroll left in the bank as a nonprofit organization. And I was thinking, gosh, I'm not sure if this is really going to make it another year. And then kind of the miracle of October 2006 happened. A couple things happened. First is in October 2006, Muhammad Yunus won the Nobel Peace Prize, which overnight educated the United States and people all over the world about microcredit and microfinance. Second, we were on PBS Frontline World. It was a PBS documentary for 15 minutes on Halloween night that ended up crashing our website for 4 days. Because we're on the $22 a month server plan, right? And so it's not going to handle like that kind of TV exposure. And luckily, you know, one of our engineers, well, our only engineer, he posted up a PayPal button up on the website, and it's and he said, and he just wrote on the website, "Help us buy new servers." And over the 4 days that we were down, we raised $130,000. From the internet community to basically get Kiva back online. And that was, I guess, in Silicon Valley terms, like a Series A financing round for us. You know, it really kind of got us the cash reserves that we needed to actually pay our staffs a living wage, put people on healthcare, and really start scaling our due diligence. And not only that, it was a jolt of awareness, October 2006, about microfinance and how you, with $25 and a credit card, can be a microlender yourself. And so then, from that point on, we decided to run on tips, which is where every time you make a loan on Kiva, we ask you, like, if you go to a restaurant, you're supposed to tip the waiter. We ask you if you'll throw in a tip for Kiva. And last year, those tips covered about 70% of our operating budget. And over the next 5 years, we think it'll cover 100% of our operating budget, these online tips. So that's how we're trying to keep the lights on in addition to keeping our costs really low. But that was a real big struggle in the beginning. The second big struggle was after October 2006, people started coming to the site super fast. And once our site came back up, we kept running out of loans on the site. In fact, Christmas of October 2006, or Christmas of December 2006, Christmas of 2007, people would log into Kiva with a Kiva gift certificate, and there'd be no loans on the site for people to fund. And it's so rare in philanthropy for people to say, "We can't take your money," because clearly there are people in the world who could benefit from these loans, but we somehow could not scale our due diligence and monitoring fast enough to actually get loans on the site. And so the internet community was hitting us in this kind of exponential or parabolic curve, and we're only able to get loans on the site in this kind of linear curve. And so one of the biggest things that we did to resolve that are one, it came down to incredible people, mainly volunteers, and two, technology. And I think the company that's really pioneered this that we looked at was Wikipedia. Wikipedia, if you know their story, they're less than 10 years old, and they're one of the top 10 most popular websites on the internet, and it's a nonprofit. And for the longest time, they only had 4 employees, and what they did is it's all these volunteers who are chipping in, editing articles, reviewing each other's work, and it's the software that helps manage all those people, even though they have such a small group of employees. Well, similarly, Kiva didn't have that many employees, so we couldn't send people all around the world. So what we did is we created a program called the Kiva Fellows Program. And what it allowed people to do, because there's so much interest in microfinance, it allowed a mid-career professional to take 3 months off of their job or a year off of their job, and we would train them in the Kiva office, and we'll deploy them like a mini Peace Corps assignment into one of the countries that we worked in. And they would help basically do a lot of the setting up of Kiva, helping train that local microfinance organization on how to use the system, helping doing the monitoring of the organization to make sure that the money that is actually being lent is getting to that person and the amount that's actually happening. All of that infrastructure essentially was done through our volunteer network. The other big part of our volunteer network was we realized a lot of organizations, they wouldn't come onto Kiva because, for example, in Honduras, they couldn't hire someone who spoke English. And so what we did is we created a huge core, over 500 people who every day will log in and review things or translate things from Spanish to English or French to English. And that allows these organizations not to have to hire like an English speaker. And so essentially it's through this whole group of volunteers. There's over 700 volunteers now in the Kiva ecosystem. And for every one staff member, there are 10 volunteers that really helped scale the system. The other thing that really helped us get loans on the site is we realized that by being really creative and hiring some great people who understood technology quite well, that you could really scale things efficiently. One example is we'd see organizations come onto Kiva and they'd start raising money for about 50 entrepreneurs. And then you're supposed to start reposting payments back to the website. But we saw them stopping, like they wouldn't post any repayments. And the whole idea of the model is that, you know, it's not a donation, it's actually a loan. You're supposed to get your money back. But they stopped reporting repayments. And what we learned when we actually flew out to East Africa, which is where we first started, is that the internet connectivity is so slow that loading every single page would take minutes at a time, and then it would just time out sometimes. And so what we realized is in microfinance, things go right 95% of the time. The repayments usually come in, and only 5% of the time do things actually go off schedule. And so what we created is, for example, an exception-based processing system, where instead of people having to mark every time a repayment came in on our website that was loading so slowly from, from Tanzania, they only needed to mark when things were going wrong. And that made Kiva much more usable for them. So it's like little innovations like that on the technology, as well as the help of all the folks, all the volunteers that allowed us to really start scaling and getting loans on the site from over 50 countries. And then the final problem that we faced is that when people would get repaid back, a lot of people thought it was a donation, and they wouldn't come back to Kiva. In fact, today we have well over $10 million just sitting in Kiva lenders' accounts that are not being put to work in the hands of other people because people won't come back to the website to actually reloan their money. And so we've been really thinking hard about how can we keep our lenders engaged. And the big thing, I think the big innovation that we've stumbled upon in the last 5 years is that we can actually make the site much more fun and much more social. Facebook, for example, is an incredibly engaging site. Some would argue an addictive site. They have over 500 million people who've registered, and half of us who have log in every single day. And so one of the things that we decided to do is create lending teams and groups on Kiva, because social movements are inherently social. And on Kiva today, you can actually join with other people to form a team. So there's over 15,000 teams. The top two teams right now are the atheists and the Christians, and they're competing against each other, and they even have like message boards, and there's trash talking, and it's all with the right intention of alleviating poverty. But you know what we want to do is actually make this thing as fun and compelling as possible. And one of my favorite lending teams on Kiva is the Women Who Lend to Shirtless Men lending team. This is a group of women that basically have come together, and they pick when men are listed on the website that aren't wearing a shirt, typically from Southeast Asia that I've seen, they will jump right on those loans. And so, you know, this is I think the what we need to continually do that I think philanthropy historically hasn't really thought about is we shouldn't underestimate fun. And one of the things, you know, I've been asked, who do you view as Kiva's competition? And I actually think that our biggest competition is battling for people's attention. Because, you know, you're hardly spending any money if you're getting it back. It's just really kind of getting people engaged on this platform. And every month, 60 million people are building virtual farms on Farmville on Facebook. And every month, only 60,000 people, less than, you know, 0.1% of that number, is actually building real farms on Kiva. And so how do I make building real farms on Kiva as compelling as building virtual farms on Facebook? That's what we want to think about. And that's the kind of Silicon Valley breakthroughs we want to bring to the site. So that's a little bit about the three challenges and what we're doing to address them. Let me talk about one of the things that we see happening on Kiva that's different from a bank and different from donations. We think that Kiva plays in this middle space isn't quite in a commercial rate of return investment, right? You're not getting a rate of return it's not a donation. And what is this middle space? And we like to call it connected capital, and it has a few attributes. One of the things that we're realizing is that when people can see the impact, they're willing to be much more patient with their money. The second thing is that because there's so many people who hit the website every day 90,000 people come to the Kiva website, it's a real distributed form of people making bets on different people. And that kind of democratization of who gets to participate in lending is really exciting. That hasn't really happened in the last ever. It's really been banks up till now. The third thing is that, you know, if you can get people who are patient and get them from all over the place, you can actually make sure that money is really catalytic. And it can only be catalytic, and people will be willing to do this if there's accountability on the other end. I don't think people really value getting paid back. It's not like they want the money back. They like the information of getting paid back because there's an accountability there that often is lacking with donations. And so with those things, essentially, those attributes of the capital that's flowing on Kiva, we're able to do something that's pretty exciting. I think we can reach places that commercial capital will not reach. So let me talk, for example, about the continent of Africa. There's a familiar story of civil strife that will be then followed by aid, and then the aid will dry up, and markets may not get a chance to deepen, and institutions may not actually get to a point of total strength, where then the population is left in a place where civil strife can reemerge. And we've seen this cycle kind of over and over and over. And one of the things that we're learning about microfinance, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, is that commercial investors are not excited about actually investing in these places because the country risk appears to be too high, or there's not enough information about these organizations on the ground. It just feels too risky. But this is exactly where we think the internet community, with their patient impact-seeking capital, would want to put their money. And so what we're seeing now today is that Kiva actually funds more local organizations in post-conflict Africa than any other funder. And I want to talk about one particular organization that we're working with on the ground in Sierra Leone. This is amazing. This organization, basically a couple of years ago, Kiva was their first outside funder. And essentially because they were able to develop a track record of showing how the entrepreneurs in their community have repaid on the Kiva website reliably, other outside funders now have come on board and started supporting this organization. In essence, the internet community has been a catalyst, the substance that then creates a chain reaction for this organization to actually provide inclusive financial services in a place like Sierra Leone, where there's really not many points of access on basic financial services. So this is one of the really exciting things that I think we can do, continue to do. We see loans in Iraq as being one of the most popular loans on the website. It may be more risky, but people actually are seeking those. Loans in Afghanistan are also incredibly exciting to people as well. So this is something that we want to continue to do more and more. And I think connected capital, as opposed to maybe commercial capital, has a role of being this first loss, risk-tolerant, catalytic capital that we haven't seen before, that's much more abundant than donations. For the next 5 years, there's three things that we want to do at Kiva. The first is that we'd like to scale from, today we're at about $180 million, and we'd like to reach $1 billion in $25 increments from everyday people on the internet. Not Bill Gates, but everyday people on the internet. The second is that we'd like to hit break even as an organization, because we'd like to show that nonprofits can actually run as a social business. No one's going to get rich from Kiva, but we can run in a way that we don't have to ask outside foundations that have been really generous thus far, like Skoll Foundation has been an incredible supporter of us, or Amidyar Network has been a great supporter of us. But ideally, one day, it's the tips on the website that will actually help operate the site. And finally, we'd like to innovate in new areas. And let me get into kind of two things that we'd like to do. First is we'd like to deepen the connection. This is the first time, I think, our generation, we're going to live in this time where it's going to be possible for every single human being on the planet, in the next 100 years to actually connect with one another. And that is a really amazing thing. And one thing that we can do is if you look at the proliferation of mobile phones in the places that we work, it's incredible. I can imagine one day, not even in a very distant future, where, say, a woman in Kenya who wants to buy that cow to start a dairy business would pull out her mobile phone because the price of phones have gone down so low. She can take a photo of herself, a photo of the cow, and then basically punching in a few keys, post that up on the Kiva website. And then maybe at that point, it won't be 90,000 people coming to the site every day, but maybe millions of people are coming to the Kiva website every day, and they can sift through, and they'll see this woman in Kenya who 3 minutes ago just posted a loan request for the equivalent of $500. So then they can come in and within, you know, hours or maybe even minutes, fund that loan. And on Kiva today, the average loan request, again, is about $400, and it gets funded in 2 days, so very quickly. In a matter of minutes, hours, or maybe a couple of days, that woman can get her loan fully funded at an interest rate that's lower than she's ever had access to from either the village money lender or any other source. And then she can go, and the question is, how does she get the money out of the system? Well, what's amazing in Kenya right now is the fastest growing financial service is actually people using their cell phone minutes as a form of currency. So now what they're doing is that you can actually go to a gas station and cash your cell phone minutes for local Kenyan shillings. And you can take those Kenyan shillings out and buy that cow right there. And then basically if she pays that loan, she knows that her future loan from the internet community that's coming at a very low interest rate will be insured because she has a great track record of repaying. Similar to how credit bureaus work here, except with banks, it's just people. And so that's one thing that I think we can do is we can move to that kind of world where people can participate in each other's stories and ultimately increase access at a much lower cost. The second thing that we've seen is that it's not just only about helping entrepreneurs start or grow their own business or actually helping people smooth their own consumption. We're seeing that there's many different forms where connected capital can actually go where commercial banks wouldn't go. For example, student lending. Student lending in the developing world doesn't really happen. And the reason why, it's a chicken and egg problem. There's really no repayment track record on student loans, and because there's no real repayment track record, banks won't get into it. And because banks won't get into it, there's no repayment track record, and so you have this chicken and egg issue. Well, that's exactly what the internet community should be funding. We should be able to kind of take on a little bit more of a risky loan or a longer-term loan, maybe instead of like 12 months, it could be 3 years or 5 years with no payments for several months, in order to fund a student's college education. And then if we can show that, wow, you know, when you lend to women who get accounting degrees in Peru, they pay back at 96% versus men who, you know, might get a mechanics degree in Lebanon, they pay back at 82%. If we can show that kind of data on a public website, then I think the banks will start coming in and actually saying, well, here's how we actually think about risk when it comes to student lending. And we want to do this not only across student lending, but housing, water. You can imagine kind of the different areas that connected capital and patient capital, if we're willing to be more patient with our money, where it could actually help address a market failure and really make a catalytic difference. So let me just conclude by saying that, you know, Kiva, you know, a lot of people talk about the soul of it being a technology company, and we're based here in Silicon Valley. But I really don't think it's that. In fact, I think a lot of us are inspired by this quote from Dr. King. He said, through our technological prowess, the world has become a neighborhood, but through our spiritual progress, the world can become a brotherhood. And I really think this is just a platform that can allow us to connect with one another in this beautiful way, sharing each other's stories. You know, if you look at the data right now, you know, it's hard not to be a pessimist. But if you look at what's happening on this website, everyday people connecting through lending to alleviate poverty, it's hard not to be an optimist. And I thank you for your optimism and for letting me be here tonight. And I look forward to the Q&A.
Our thanks to Premal Shah, an outstanding social entrepreneur who has helped change the lives of small business owners and communities around the world. I am going to ask him to stand up here, and I'll ask him some questions. But I just, out of curiosity, and this is not fair to the radio audience, How many people in the audience have been on the Kiva site? How many have made loans? Okay, well, there's still some work to be done there, I think. We have potential growth right here in this room. But for the radio audience, everyone raised their hands that they had been on the Kiva site. I think checking out the competition between the atheists and the Christians, maybe. Okay. Premal, we have three types of questions. One category are specific questions about Kiva itself. Second is about microfinance as an industry, if you will. And then the third is about your story as a social entrepreneur. So let's start with the Kiva questions. For those who are familiar with the Grameen Bank model, you in order to get a loan, you have to be part of a group. And that group helps to, for lack of a better word, I suppose, apply some pressure or some social pressure for everyone to give back what they borrowed. Your site has individual people running individual businesses. In order for them to get money, do they still need to be part of the group?
So our website actually has groups and individuals. Uh-huh. In the beginning, our software only allowed individuals, and this is one of the learnings, is that when we went out to the field partners, many of them actually did solidarity groups, groups of five women or eight women who'd basically provide that kind of peer support, that peer guarantee that creates the high repayment rates. And then from there, we saw actually village banks, which are literally 40-person groups or 60-person groups. And now, so you'll see on the Kiva website, for example, in the Congo, huge groups where you can barely see the person up on the website, and there's both on the site today.
Okay. But then you can get a loan as an individual. You need not, right? I just want to clarify.
That's right. You know, in microfinance, one thing that's interesting is that the original innovation of Dr. Yunus was he learned that by forming these solidarity groups, it instead of financial collateral, there's reputational collateral. And that's what actually got these repayment rates to be as high as they did. But when you actually talk to clients, the actual entrepreneurs in microfinance, many of them actually would like to actually graduate from that group. It saves them time to actually be able to get a loan directly. And so what you'll see is after a few loans as a group member, if they have a high repayment rate, they graduate to an individual loan. And then it's basically the opportunity to get a future loan, you know, for example, to finance the inventory in their small business that gets them to continue to repay, similar to what we have here in the U.S. The reason why we tend to repay our credit card bills or our mortgages is because we want to preserve our credits, our own credit scores, so we have access to future opportunities.
So then, given that, are the rates of repayment between the individuals and the group about the same?
You know, I haven't seen a huge differential between the individual and the group repayments. It's an interesting stat worth checking.
Yeah.
One of the things is, again, because the individuals tend to be graduates from the group, or there's a good reason why people feel comfortable on the ground.
Right.
So everyone has an incentive to make sure that the repayment rate is as high as possible. I haven't seen a huge difference between the two.
You said that you do fund in the United States, and I said that in my intro. Actually, Premal and I met at an Opportunity Fund event. There is questions about why you do that, and maybe you could talk a little bit about what those loans look like and your work in the United States.
Sure. So the United States was Kiva's 48th country. And before we launched in the United States, we would get customer service emails every day saying, why aren't you in the United States? I want to lend to someone here. Poverty isn't just abroad, or lack of access to capital is not just a problem abroad, it's a problem here. And in the middle of the great credit crunch, you know, we were inspired to really explore this and learn about the microfinance industry here in the United States. And we're pleased to learn that there's a great organization here in the Bay Area called Opportunity Fund. And we launched with another organization in New York that serves the five boroughs. What was really the thing that we didn't know would happen is we didn't know if this would actually cannibalize the amount of money that's going to the developing world, which was there was a lot of concern about that, or if it actually expand the pie because more people would be interested in Kiva for the first time. And what was really interesting to see is that it looks like it actually expanded the pie. By actually having businesses here in the United States, it attracted a whole new set of people that otherwise would not have used the website. And then we followed their behavior on the website, and we saw that they'd add over time 2 to 3 other loans in other countries. And so that was a really exciting thing to learn. The other exciting thing to watch was I saw a loan from someone in Kenya to someone here in San Francisco. And I guess this shows which way the world is going, which is we're blurring the lines between, which way money flows on the website. And so I think that's another really exciting thing to see. And we just launched in the Gulf Coast recently, and those loans have been incredibly popular.
So when you say you've launched in the Gulf Coast, one of the questions is, obviously, most of your money still at this point, the donors are from the United States. But what are the next big countries in terms of donors?
So first of all, we call them lenders, not donors. Think of it as if you spot your friend some money when you think about Kiva, because I'm trying to figure out, like, what exactly is this? It's not a donation. It's not commercial capital. I think the simplest thing is if you spot a friend, someone you know, you have a personal relationship with money, you're not expecting interest, but you'd like to get paid back one day. And that's kind of what's happening, and you're developing this kind of, you're able to share in the story of someone and have that personal connection with someone else. In terms of what percentage of our donors comes from kind of which other countries, so 80% is from the U.S., and then the next 20% come from over 100 countries. The second largest country is Canada and UK, Australia. So it's kind of mapping to English-speaking internet adoption right now. But what I get really excited about is, you know, where it's going. In my travels, you see internet cafes and mobile phones in the most remote places. And I think as people, you know, the ideal is as entrepreneurs themselves who get funded on Kiva generate their own discretionary income, they can turn around and support someone else on the platform.
Now, excuse me if you answered this. I can't recall. You get your money back, I know. But do you get interest back?
No.
You don't?
No.
Okay. Because there was one question about concern about the capital gains on that interest. And I think we've mitigated that.
Yeah, so some people have joked that Kiva is a really bad investment from a financial point of view, because the best you can do is get your money back. I think investing in people, over 80% of the people on our website are women, is probably one of the best investments you can make. So, I think what we've watched is people will start Kiva with putting in $25 and kind of testing the waters. And then once they start getting those $2.50 repayments, it starts becoming very real. Mm-hmm. And now we have people who have put in over 7 figures into Kiva.
Okay. There's a number of questions about, obviously the end game here is poverty alleviation. And that was what you started thinking about when you were 5 years old in India. How can you measure any kind of impact that Kiva has on poverty alleviation?
You know, I think one of the debates in microfinance right now is to what degree is microfinance actually alleviating poverty? And I think one way that I think about it is I'm actually stepping back from, does it actually affect poverty, to is access to financial service a basic right? So I think the ability to turn small payments, if you're living on $2 a day, into a large lump sum to capture an opportunity, whether it's, you know, buying that cow or paying for a medical expense, I think that's a valuable thing. I think other financial services like savings and insurance are incredibly valuable as well. Does that actually result in you getting out of poverty? Not always. Does that just help you cope with poverty? Oftentimes, that's the value of these loans. Now, just like education or healthcare, those two things don't exactly get that person out of poverty as well. But what we're seeing is it's one step in kind of many different things that need to happen in order to create the conditions of choice so that people can have the opportunity, the dignity to live a life up to their most potential. I think what we could see, though, is the more patient the internet community is, with their loans, the more social impact we're going to be able to see. So what I'd like to see is expanding into things like micro-mortgages, where people could actually, today, this really does not exist, the idea of a 30-year fixed mortgage in the developing world. You really are kind of living in short cash flow cycles. But would the internet community be willing to finance someone for 10 years or 15 years with no payments or minimal payments until kind of an income stream is generated? This is the kind of experimentation I like to see so that people who are being told no today around getting access to credit are being told yes in the future.
Which leads me to a question. You use the term inspired by trust in your talk, and I wrote that down. I like that term because trust is very useful. It's fundamental, but it's underrated. And do you think, what is it? Is it the Kiva website that's supplying that modicum of trust, or how do you build that?
So on the Kiva website today, we have... One is just we have kind of a 5-star rating system, kind of like Morningstar with mutual funds. And if you're a 1-star microfinance organization, you can only raise $25,000. And then as you pay all that back, you can become a 2-star or a 3-star. And if you're a 5-star organization, you can post up to $1 million of entrepreneurs in your community. And one of the things that I think really inspires trust is over time, people just getting their money back. Because if you're getting your money back, that's proof that something's working. And this is why, you know, I think it's so important that while the credit is done really responsibly on the ground, that there is a real insistence to actually get the repayment rates, as well, because it continues to foster the trust in the system and opportunity for more people.
Okay. There's obviously a wide variation on the ability and capacity of the microfinance organizations that you work with. And many of us who have spent time in emerging markets or the developing world know that it's not necessarily that people or organizations are corrupt, but they may not have the skill sets to really provide the governance and the accountability that they need. So, do you help build capacity of your partners? And if so, how does that work?
So the closest thing that we do to helping build capacity for the microfinance organization is our Kiva Fellows program. Mm-hmm. Let me give you a story of a Kiva Fellow. He's from the Bay Area. His name's Dave McMurtry. And he was a director of business development at Intuit. So held a fairly senior post. Even tried to raise money from Silicon Valley VCs for some startups that he had, and decided to go for 3 months to Liberia in West Africa. And today, in Liberia, there's not much commercial capital flowing in. He arrives on the ground with the Kiva Field partner, and he realizes that this organization is on the brink of insolvency. And so instead of just focusing on basically training that organization on how to post the entrepreneur profiles on the Kiva website, he actually focuses on, one, strengthening board governance, because it turned out that a lot of people were afraid to invest in the organization. So strengthening the board governance, getting kind of their management information systems in place, and then finally actually writing grant proposals. I mean, he ended up securing $1 million from UNDP. And so that then is a cash infusion for that organization to hire maybe an operations director or an internal controls person, things that a typical bank should have that a lot of community-based organizations don't start out with. To put you into the mindset of how a lot of microfinance organizations might start, it might literally be a pastor who starts lending to a church congregation and then realizes, wow, there's a lot of demand here, and they decide to actually start an NGO, a non-governmental organization. But that pastor who originally starts may not have all the experience in banking that's needed to sustain an operation and reach hundreds of thousands of people. And this is why capacity building is so important in the sector.
There's a number of people who want to be Kiva Fellows in this group, so which is terrific. Can you just talk for a second about how they would go about doing that?
Sure. So you can go to our website and read through the information on the Kiva Fellows section and even the blog that's running, which is one of my favorite things to read. And you can apply. There's 4 classes a year. It's a competitive process. About 1 in 4 who apply get accepted. And, we've seen people from recent college grads to people in at the very end of their careers. And we'll train you in San Francisco for a week. And then, you know, you can state your preferences on where you want to go, but we've had over 350 now Kiva Fellows go to over 40 countries.
And do your lenders visit the projects they lend to?
You know, as one of the interesting things about the launching in the U.S. is it's allowed for people to more easily visit the business that they've lent to. And what's really interesting is there's a business here in San Francisco that actually sold board games that was listed on the Kiva website, and they saw their sales really increase because people would come in off their website. They said, "Oh, I saw you on Yelp, or I'd see you on Kiva." Like, it was one of the two places that was actually driving traffic to their real store. And you know, I think one thing that we're seeing is that people, while they can't oftentimes visit, and we have had lenders go and visit, and like Nick Kristof, for example, the New York Times reporter, went to Afghanistan to visit the borrower that he funded. While people don't always have the means to actually go and fly there, what we're hoping to do is make the world through technology a lot smaller. Mm-hmm. And so you can imagine a day where there's actually Skype chats or Skype videos or actually kind of mobile SMS updates on how the cow that you purchased is doing. This is where we want to go with the technology.
I don't think, Premal, you can go and have a conversation anywhere without talking about for-profit microfinance organizations. And actually, there's 8 questions about that. We know that there's for-profit microfinance. We know they're quite controversial. Can you just talk a minute about the difference between for-profit and non-profit microfinance and what you think the rationale is for your approach?
Sure. So let me walk through the life cycle of a microfinance organization. Just like, you know, Dr. Eunice, who started with a small group of people, or maybe that pastor, if we go back to that example, that pastor who starts lending to people in his congregation, will then form an organization, and usually it's a nonprofit organization. And today on Kiva's platform, over 80% of the organizations on the platform are nonprofit. And the average profitability rate of the organizations, if you combine them, is negative on Kiva. So they're not yet sustainable. But of course, what we all want in the end of the day on our deathbeds is the idea that if I live in rural Sierra Leone, I can actually walk into an organization that will be around for a long time because they're now accepting my deposits as well, and that can really, you can trust that they'll be sustainable. So Kiva's view on this is that sustainability is a good thing. Hitting profitability or ability to cover your costs, this is exactly why I love microcredit and microfinance. Now, it can be abused, and like a lot of great things, there's some bad apples, and there's need for things like regulation and a lot more self-restraint. What we've seen, for example, in India, which has been in the news in southern India, Kiva will not work in southern India, for example, because we feel like the microfinance market there is very competitive, and there's a lot of kind of big microfinance institutions, one which just actually had an initial public offering that made investors tens of millions of dollars, including Silicon Valley investors like Sequoia Capital. It's not a bad thing because they're expanding to be an institution, but it's not the role of the internet community, we believe, to provide subsidized capital. What we'd like to see is a couple things, and stuff that you've seen here in the United States. More regulation once the microfinance industry actually matures. So, for example, in the U.S., they have the Truth in Lending Act. Transparency on pricing is key. You know, the idea that there's an APR or nutrition facts box when you apply for a credit card, and it still wasn't good enough. I mean, we still had to introduce more regulation because people still didn't understand with credit cards what they were getting into. You can imagine right now with populations that aren't exactly that don't have high literacy or high numeracy, there's a lot of confusion around what the interest rate is and which loan is actually the best loan for me. So regulation around pricing transparency and a lot of actually monitoring, which is Kiva, what Kiva and other social funders want to do, that's a really key issue. The second thing is that there should be local credit bureaus. In southern India today, what's happening is the problem called over-indebtedness. A borrower, and this happens here in the United States, A borrower will get a loan from one microfinance organization and another one, and start basically repaying one loan with another loan. And one of the things that's happening is that these microfinance organizations are unable to actually talk to each other. There's no credit bureau to say, wow, this person is actually pretty significantly in debt. And so one of the things that's actually precipitated this crisis in India is that the local government-run self-help group, microfinance provider, essentially, because they were more flexible, when people started getting loans from multiple sources, they were being paid last. That combined with suicides of about 40 farmers who were basically in over their head, it's absolutely tragic, got a lot of media attention, and the government in southern India actually shut down the microfinance sector. And now, in southern India, there's nothing short of a crisis. But this crisis is good because, like the mortgage bubble here in the United States, it's an opportunity for us to learn and to actually do things in a way that is actually in line with our values and the original reasons why microfinance first started. So, I think through better regulation, through credit bureaus, and then basically through more responsible players, including the people who are investing, I think we can actually make sure that there's minimal damage as we try to expand access to the poor.
And surprisingly, there's very few countries that have credit, really good credit bureaus. You don't know how many.
Very few. I mean, we see, for example, different efforts to actually begin reporting to a central credit bureau, and I think this is going to be really, really exciting. You know, one day my vision is that the data on Kiva could actually be appended to local credit bureaus so that people, for example, if you move from Kampala, Uganda to Nairobi, Kenya, you're no longer part of that same credit bureau, but you can at least point to the internet and say, look, I've taken four successful loans out, and I've paid them all, and essentially your credit history moves with you.
Yeah, that would be great. You mentioned several times that the interest rate that your borrowers get when they take out a loan from a microfinance organization funded by Kiva is lower than what they could get otherwise. But sometimes people are surprised at what that number is. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if you could talk about what is the range of those interest rates, and how much subsidy does the microfinance organization need in order to make that loan and then service that loan?
Okay, so the way we look at interest rates is actually, it's not just interest rates, but it's also fees. So we try to create an APR-like calculation called portfolio yield. And mm-hmm. if you look at the average across the Kiva platform, it's about 35%, which strikes people in the West as extremely high. Now, if you look at the organizations on Kiva that are here in the U.S., the range of the interest rate is about 9 to 12%, which seems a lot more reasonable for, but that's because the cost of making a loan in the United States is actually lower than the cost of making a loan in the developing world. Couple reasons. One, we're seeing that the infrastructure is not there to actually get to that last mile, to that village. There's no online banking. There's no, it's literally bankers on bicycles who moped out. And so the cost structure of delivering a $100 loan, because it costs just as much to do a $100 loan as it does to do a $1,000 loan, it's actually quite high. The second thing that we're seeing is that every year, as microfinance matures in competitive markets, the interest rate is coming down about 2% a year. So I think the trend is the right thing, and what's driving that is three things. First is, as organizations go from maybe that church group to a local an NGO to essentially kind of an NGO, a microfinance organization that's scaling, they're able to scale their cost over a larger base. So they get operating efficiencies, and they kind of figure out how to run it more and more efficiently. Second, competition comes into the market, which is really a great thing. And this is why we want to fund many microfinance organizations and have a healthy, vibrant, competitive market. And the third is actual technology. Mm-hmm. Technology, for example, mobile payments. If it costs so much money to go out 2 hours on a moped through monsoon season on a bumpy road to reach a group of women in a village, well, then if they can actually, with their mobile phones, actually receive that loan and make loan repayments, you're actually cutting out all that cost. So those three things are, contributing to a drop in interest rates over time. And, this is a really exciting thing. I want to add one more thing. If you ask actually borrowers, clients in Africa, what is it that they really value, interest rate and the price that they pay is number three. The first thing that they value is actually how fast can they get the loan, because oftentimes the opportunity is fleeting, whether or not you need to plant right for that moment in order to get that you know, hit that kind of window for the harvest, or the second reason is the size of the loan. Oftentimes they're able to get like a very small loan from a family member or friend, but what they need is, you know, the average cow might cost $500, and that's actually just well beyond anyone in their neighbor's means. So those two things also seem to be valued more, which is why a pure focus on cost isn't always right as well.
Okay. Kiva is right in the middle of this space that challenges the notion of for-profit and nonprofit. So obviously Kiva is a nonprofit organization, but you're engaged in a business in a very significant way. One of the themes of social entrepreneurship is that blurring of the lines between profit and nonprofit. What's your stand on that? Is there a particular formula? Is there a right way? Is there something that you're excited about in terms of the blurring of that demarcation?
You know, what I love about social entrepreneurship is people are really focusing on what works, and they're bringing a business rigor to it, no matter what your tax status is. To be a nonprofit or a for-profit, it's really just a tax status. And for Kiva, it's completely a pragmatic decision to be a 501c3 nonprofit. And here's why. It's a lot like Wikipedia. Wikipedia is a nonprofit, and I often point to this example. And I think if any small group of people were making profit off of Wikipedia, a lot of the people who contribute to that internet public good would not feel so good about contributing all their free time. But because no one is really profiting from it, and it truly is an internet public good, actually a lot of people are contributing to it, and this is why it's grown to the heights that it has. In fact, right now, only one out of three articles are in English. It literally is a global internet public good, and it's less than 10 years old, Wikipedia. Similarly, Kiva likes to think of itself as an internet public good, and the only reason we can scale after 5 years to 54 countries and kind of do this at a cost structure is because no one person is trying to make a profit, and we all are trying to do it for, you know, basically it's not the currency of money, it's the currency of meaning. Mm-hmm. And it's a very powerful currency, and so I think it's not fair to kind of think in this old paradigm that if it's not for profit, it won't scale. Because look at Wikipedia. I point to that as a nonprofit that has now scaled to huge heights. And I think I look at Kiva's trajectory. It's another nonprofit that's scaling. I think it's just more of a pragmatic thing that in our case, you know, we felt like this is the way that we could scale by being a nonprofit and make the most impact.
Prema, why is Kiva not yet in China?
So the reason why Kiva's not in China is because it's the government makes it difficult for foreign investors to put money into China. And the same problem is with all the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, and China. We're not in any of those countries. The spirit of the laws for the government is, I think, to protect people, protect the local population against what they call hot money. It's where investors like George Soros or someone will come in, put a lot of money into the economy, and then something will happen with the currency, and they'll pull money out. And when they pull a lot of money out, these hedge funds, it really disrupts the local economy and it affects the population. That's what the regulation's written for, and Kiva is ensnared. The internet community is ensnared, and this is quite frustrating for me, is ensnared in that regulation. And so what we're trying to do is work with the regulators and work with local groups to help explain that actually Kiva is not like George Soros. There should be actually different regulation for connected capital here, because the intention is to help. The intention is not to exploit. No one's making money off of it. And ultimately, this is going to help advance the goals of the local government. So we're hopeful that over time this will change.
So we've reached the time for our last question, and it's I want to just circle back to Oprah, and because there's several people who want to give Kiva gift certificates for Christmas, and I think there's still a couple of days of Hanukkah left. How do you do that?
Well, first of all, we just launched in Israel today.
Okay.
so now you can lend to entrepreneurs in Israel,
That's
because
appropriate.
You mentioned Hanukkah. You know, My thing when people ask, what's the thing that I want to do something, I want to do something to improve the world, and I'm a huge believer in focusing on the smallest thing you can do in the present moment. And I think Kiva is one channel of many to do that. We try to make it simple for you to make a $25 loan or buy a gift certificate. It makes a great stocking stuffer. In fact, we just did a deal with Groupon, which we'll be launching next week, where you can get a discounted Kiva gift certificate from Groupon funded by an outside donor. So it's even easier and cheaper for you to give this a try. But, you know, there's more ways than just your money to get involved and more ways than just Kiva. And what's really exciting, I think, again, is this movement that, you know, makes one optimistic when the statistics actually would make you pessimistic. So, you know, hopefully we can continue to make it simpler and simpler for people to participate.
Our thanks to Premal Shah for this amazing talk. And for all your hard work and your game-changing efforts. I also want to thank our audience here on the radio, television, and the internet. Today's program has been the 8th in the Commonwealth Club series on social entrepreneurship. Please check our website for those programs in 2011. We ended this year on a very high note with Premal Shah. I'm Ruth Shapiro. Thank you very much.
Thank you.